Arise England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. Between 1199 and 1399, English politics was high drama. These two centuries witnessed savage political bloodletting, including civil war, deposition, the murder of kings, and the ruthless execution of rebel lords, as well as an international warfare, devastating national pandemic, economic crisis, and the first major peasant uprising in English history. Who said that history is dead? Right then, talking to us all about Arise England, which is Six Kings and the Making of the English State. Delighted to say I'm joined by Caroline Burt and Richard Partington, who are the authors of this tome. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Charles. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you with us. As the saying goes, what have the Plantagenets ever done for us, Caroline? Let's draw a timeline here, because this is a particular house, a particular line of kings that have been sadly overlooked by those media tarts, the Windsors, the Tudors.
Yeah, so the Tudors have had a lot of attention from historians and from the general public, and still do. And the Tudors are, don't get me wrong, a really interesting, really exciting period. What we're trying to do in this book is say, well, actually, there are other periods earlier in history that have a lot to say to us, and about which there's a lot of really interesting evidence that brings characters to life and events to life. And this period in particular is foundational, really, for the English state in terms of the legal system, Parliament, the idea of a government beneath the law, professional armies, national taxation. All of those are things that really came into being in this period.
Richard, so before the Plantagenets, who have we got? Are we still looking at the if you like, the repercussions, the shockwaves from 1066 and all that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So obviously you've got the Anglo-Saxon state, which was already actually, by the standards of 10th century, 11th century states, quite centralised. Then the Norman conquest, which added a further layer of centralisation. And then things really take off, I think, with the creation of the common law in 1166, a single legal system for everyone, accessible by ordinary people. And that was a really revolutionary thing, actually. And it's from that creation of the common law in 1166 that, in a way, all of our liberties emanate. And the legal system in which we, on which we depend today is absolutely recognisable 800 years ago. It's an extraordinary thing.
Caroline, because people get a misconception, don't they, about the Middle Ages? Because a lot of them will think, OK, it's too far back. Perhaps their history. It takes, because learning history at school is a bit strange, because you do 1066 and then you kind of leap. You might do the Wars of the Roses and Richard III because of a certain playwright. Then you'll slap into the Tudors and the Elizabethan age, and then you bounce to the English Civil War, and then the next thing you know, you're in Victorian era, basically. So we miss it out in this period. So what we kind of think of is okay, it's feudal, it's peasants being oppressed, it's basically Monty Python and the Holy Grail in real life. And yet we tend to overlook, okay, it's a tough existence, but there are, as Richard just said, there are the beginnings of a system that is put down, which basically sets international law that we still use today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, for that reason, I think it's incredibly interesting for people now to look at this, given that they're not likely to know very much about it in the first place, because of the way in which we tend to learn history at school. So this has a huge amount to offer from that perspective, to understand exactly where things that are completely foundational and that we take absolutely for granted came from in the first place. Like Magna Carta is absolutely core to why we have a situation in which government has to obey the same law as all of the rest of us. Whether it does or not is another matter, but it's, it is obliged to, and it can be held to account if it doesn't do so. And what that means is, and again, this comes from that period, that if you're the king or the government, you can't just go, oh, we'd like to fight a war, or we'd like to do this thing. So you know what? We'll just help ourselves to the property and money of our subjects. Magna Carta stopped that. He said, no, this can't happen anymore. And so that's where a whole dialogue came into being about how And when government can have access to our property, our resources, and that's when we as people started to play a real role in determining government policy. So, and this is all from this period, really.
Richard, the interesting one for you on this one is the fact that on a Tuesday mornings, I do a phone-in show, okay, called Viewpoint, where people put their viewpoints across. And obviously during, as we call it in Spain, El Brexit, otherwise known as Brexit, people were saying, we want our sovereignty, we want us to be a sovereign nation, and the number of people who were quoting Magna Carta to me.
And what's so interesting about that perspective that in the Middle Ages we were separate is that actually in many ways England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, they were absolutely part of Europe. And many of the intellectual ideas that fed into Magna Carta and other great statements of national liberty were swirling around Europe in the late 12th, 13th centuries into the 14th centuries. So England is part of this wider pattern, but it's framed in a very particular way. And I think I would point to the common law in particular as the thing that is so different here. The fact that everyone, every free person, man or woman, has access to the same law, which also governs the king and the government. It's an extraordinary thing, and that to me is right at the heart of our liberties. That's why Magna Carta is so important, but it's not important because it makes England separate and different. It makes England exceptional, but in a European way, I would say.
The other thing, the interesting thing, of course, this would be a hard enough act to pull off in, say, the 18th century or the 19th century, but this is happening over 200 years at the beginning of the last millennium, and there are a few bits and pieces going on here. There are, as we've mentioned, I mean, the English kings, I mean, the Plantagenets, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, that's a French lineage as well, because we're fighting over France, etc. So it's quite amazing that they managed to pull this off despite kingmakers and bloodletting and you know, regicide, basically. Caroline.
It is. But on the other hand, I think one of the big points that we want to make is that while there are these kind of exciting moments in this period where, you know, somebody gets killed and, you know, in the most brutal way, horrible though that is, you know, those are the sorts of things that people are often really enchanted to read about. That's actually quite unusual in the overall period. The norm is much more about trying to make government work, trying to live harmoniously, trying to govern for the common good. It's those periods are where you see things go wrong, usually because of personal agency, usually because the king's incompetent or tyrannical. And of course, you can't account for genetics.
And also, of course, coming through, I mean, we've just been through an interesting situation, to put it mildly, with pandemics. Of course, back then, they didn't bother with pandemics. They just had the Black Death, which had come through every 200 years and clear everybody out. And I mean, they had, obviously, the Plantagenets had to deal with that little problem as well, Richard.
One of the most extraordinary things about the period that you have population loss in Europe of somewhere between 40 and 50%. And yet the Plantagenet state is so effective that it's able to carry on what it wants to do in terms of internal order and law giving, in terms of foreign policy. And it's engaged in a really challenging war in the Hundred Years' War at this point. And it carries on doing it almost seamlessly. It introduces legislation to help control the economy, to provide economic redress for people who are suffering in the face of the Black Death. And things continue. I mean, it's almost seamlessly business as usual, but with 40% fewer people.
Amazing. I mean, if I could just come in there, I mean, if you add to that, so you've got this kind of this business of as usual, which is absolutely right. At the same time, what was really striking to me during the COVID-19 pandemic and afterwards was this what it does to people's mentality. So people in the Middle Ages became absolutely obsessed with death and the afterlife, quite understandably. So, you know, this the Black Death was something new. It was something big for them in the same way as COVID was for us. But then what followed on was really major economic crisis, which begot political crisis. People became suspicious of elites. Governments had to work out how on earth they were going to function in terrible economic crisis, not just in England, but across Europe. And all of that, obviously, of course, will resonate with people today, very much so.
The only thing we haven't had thus far is the peasants' revolt, but it's surely a matter of time, Richard.
Well, I mean, what Caroline said is really important, because the peasants' revolt didn't happen straight after the Black Death. There was a kind of a period of economic success, an economic boom, really, that kind of kept things going for a good 20 years after the Black Death. And it was when the economy turned downwards, it was when incomes really began to be squeezed. And at the same time, there was a perceived failure of foreign policy with French attacks on the south coast of England that the peasants' revolt erupted. So it was, some of it was about long-term resentment on the part of serfs that they couldn't access the common law. That was one issue. Another issue was concern about economic control that stopped people from earning more wages. And that was a response to challenges around labour costs in the Black Death. And some of it was about this perceived sense that the government wasn't really delivering. And it, in a way, it's very strongly reminiscent of kind of what we've experienced in the last 2-3 years with attitudes to government. I mean, particularly around the sense that during the pandemic, there was one rule for one set of people, another rule for everybody else. And that's something that the government in 1348, 1349 was absolutely determined to ride out, but which then kind of came back 20, 25 years later when politicians were less effective and things started to collapse.
Yeah, and I was just going to sort of jump in on that idea that, you know, people wanted to have the same rules applying to everyone. So what happened when there was economic crisis was that in Parliament, the MPs said, oh, well, we can't really pay all of this tax ourselves because we can't really afford it anymore. But guess what? There's a load of peasants there and they've done quite well after the Black Death, so they can pay it. And what's happening in 1381 is that the peasants are kind of lineal heirs of Magna Carta in 1215 and the barons who said, you know, the king can't just take our money without our consent. The peasants said, hey, guess what? We heard that message. You can't take our money without consent. So let's talk about that. Except, of course, it was extremely violent.
Indeed, talking about extremely violent, there is in the background rumbling on the Hundred Years' War. And again, if your memory of history goes as far as Shakespeare, Henry V, because we've got Agincourt, Crécy and Poitiers, and of course Henry IV, and they seem to be sort of like the star names. But the Hundred Years' War is this brutal and never-ending series of conflicts. It's not just, you know, they're not just fighting for 100 years straight off. Richard?
Well, I think the really important thing is to recognise that what was going on here was all about really big geopolitical forces. France was expanding, and the English kings, who had started off as French noblemen, were having their lands taken away by the French, their lands in France. And the Hundred Years' War was really all about the English kings, with the support of the English people, saying enough is enough, we need to hold the line against French aggression. So that's why the war broke out in 1337. In fact, there were precursor wars. We call it the Hundred Years' War. They didn't call it the Hundred Years' War then. It was just, for them, a more intense period of conflict. And I think that it's really important to focus on England's war aims under Edward III, the first king in the Hundred Years' War, who was enormously successful until 1360. And the war aim was to secure England's lands in France without any French supervision. And that remained the war aim right until the end of the Hundred Years' War in 1453, when France, which was a much bigger, wealthier country, in the end won out because of its size and its resources. And also because at that time, the English king, Henry VI, Henry V's son, was suffering with disability and mental illness. And so there was a kind of political collapse in England as well. One of the messages that comes through from this volume all the way through, I think, Giles, is how important political leadership is. Just as today, if you have a really effective political leader focused on the common good who has broad appeal, then there is political calm. Where you have crisis is when you have government for a particular group or government that's deemed to be incompetent.
And let's go, I mean, everybody will know Henry V and Henry IV, but Henry II, I think, is the man, is he not, Caroline? I think he's very overlooked when it comes to great English kings. When you think of the size of the I don't know, not empire, but the size of the country.
Yeah, also,
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a huge undertaking which he manages to keep together with some style.
Yeah, absolutely, he does. And that, as you say, it's an absolutely huge empire when you look at it geographically. He is the king who creates the common law in England. I mean, that is where it comes from. So his reign is also absolutely pivotal internally. A lot of what Henry did internally was about bringing peace to England after a period of civil crisis. but also about finding ways to make sure that England could tick along nicely when he couldn't be there, which was actually a lot of the time. So putting in place all sorts of bits of state infrastructure that both gave him money, because England was rich, and enabled government to keep on working in his absence. And he did all of that with great panache, though in terms of the person, he was a very, very strange individual. And in family terms, his was an incredibly dysfunctional family. Just, you know, he was faced with rebellions from his own sons and his wife. I mean, and that's before we even get to Thomas Becket.
Yes, and therein lies the rub. What was this? What was the spark, the chisper, as we say, behind this, Richard? What this, you decided to put down or put together Arise England?
That's a brilliant question, Giles. So Caroline and I are historians at the University of Cambridge. We've been teaching this period and connected periods for a long time. Talking to our students, we realised how gripping so much of this was, but also we had the idea that this is a critical formative period, which tells us a lot about the way that government can work well, as well as about how government can work badly. And it's also a period about which you can talk with real vividness in terms of individuals. The source material, because of the common law in particular, is incredible. So we can talk about fully fleshed out political leaders. And we really just wanted to bring it to the general public, to get out of a purely academic environment and to try and communicate this more widely to people who are, you know, to armchair historians, people who are really interested in history and would like to be taken through what's an enormously dynamic and exciting period.
And Caroline, this is the thing about history, and I keep banging on about this, but it is the people, and it isn't dusty rooms and you know, so-and-so Robert Barons and the whole thing, because it's the living, breathing history that is out there. You've only got to scratch the surface, and it's there right in front of you.
Yeah, these are people just like us, doing their best, doing their worst, with their failings, with their talents, and often faced with incredibly challenging situations, because we're looking mostly at leaders, political leaders, under the most exceptional amounts of pressure and how they respond to that, and whether they show any capacity whatsoever for leadership and indeed for empathy or just for doing the right thing. And they can jump off the page to you from this period in a way that I think people just don't realise. But it's also history. I would say, you know, people used to joke with me when I did a job in my gap year before university, saying, well, why are you doing history? They're all dead. And I was kind of like, yeah, they're clearly not going to jump up and, you know, do something new. That's not really the point. The point is that every time one of us interacts with the past is alive. You know, that it's that conversation that we're having with the past, which is just fantastic. And once you start seeing it like that, it just is so full of life, you know.
And also, of course, we are continuing discovering, because if people think, oh, you know all about history, it's been done. But no, we are, there's new source material coming up all the time. Stuff is being revealed. People are pulling up stuff from the flagstones in crypts here, there and everywhere, or attics or whatever, and going, we never knew that. And that is why history is so vitally important. Richard, do you hope that this is going to inspire a new look at the Plantagenets, because they do need to be studied, because they are a fascinating bunch?
We absolutely hope that. History is important because people really like it, because it's really interesting, because it enables them to identify with individuals in the past, their circumstances, the challenges they face. They're infuriated by people. They love people. All of that is part of the human experience. It matters so much. But it's also really important to us that young people, potentially, you know, university students, have a look at this stuff, are inspired by it, and maybe go on to have the sorts of opportunities that we've had. We're both first-generation university students. My parents left school at 14. And so we hope that this inspires young people in particular to take forward their own acts of imagination and creativity and grow with the subject in the way that we've grown. And they'll have careers doing all sorts of things. Lots of them, of course, won't become historians. They'll go on and become bankers and lawyers and civil servants and local government officers, all sorts of things, but they'll have this as a platform for choice later in life. So we just hope it inspires people.
Not everybody is cut out for the cut and thrust of historian life, Richard and Caroline. That's the thing. Many are called, few are chosen. The book is called Arise England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. It's by Caroline Burt and Richard Partington, who are speaking to you today. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to find out more about you and about the book?
So I have a YouTube channel which has actually lots of guidance for students to try and help students generally. I'll be putting some history content up there in due course. But I'm from a working class background in the north of England, and I really want to inspire young people to, you know, to access education and to know that they can do it too.
Richard, where can they find you?
If they do a Google search on Richard Partington, you'll get The Guardian economics editor and me.
Marvellous. The book is called Arise England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. Caroline and Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
It's been a huge pleasure for us. Thank you, Giles.
And you, Giles. Thank you. And thanks to all of our European friends for listening.